This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. Joshua, we'll be back with you on Monday. A lot has been happening around the world this week. Protesters smash up the parliament in Hong Kong. In Korea, President Trump crosses a line. And the exact role of his daughter at the G20 seems to have crossed another line, this time in Japan. There's change at the top of the European Union and the central bank, and important developments in Libya and Sudan that we'll get to as well. Joining me for the International Friday News Roundup in the studio is Ron Nixon. He's the International Investigations Editor for the Associated Press, and he's author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Nina Maria Potts is also here. She's Director of Global News Coverage at Feature Story News. Nina Maria, great to see you again.
Good to be here.
Joining us on the line from the BBC in London is Michael Goldfarb. He's the host of the First Rough Draft of History podcast. Michael, great to have you.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Always good to talk to you. Gang, I want to start in Hong Kong, where there was a lot of news, some of it a little bit bewildering, from protests. There have been months of protests that culminated this week with more civil unrest there. Protesters this week stormed into the Legislative Assembly chamber with spray cans and metal bars and other weapons. It's what might happen next, though, that has a lot of very many people around China and around Hong Kong very nervous. Nina, remind us, what is this all about and why has it reached this point where previously peaceful protests, at least for the most part, seem to be tipping into violence?
Well, I mean, this latest round of protests on July 1st, which fell on the anniversary of the 1997 handover, the return of Hong Kong to China from Britain, it's really signified, I think, the latest test for Carrie Lam, the embattled chief executive of Hong Kong, and for Xi Jinping in China. It should also be said that demonstrations are shaping up now for this Sunday. Violence is expected, and significantly, these mass demonstrations on Sunday are happening on the Kowloon side of the bay, so not on Hong Kong Island. And that's significant because the streets are a lot more compact. There's the possibility of greater violence. It's harder to control. One thing that hasn't been talked about much in the press reports and the media coverage is to what extent there have been violent mainland Chinese agitators pushing these protests over the edge towards sort of uncontrollable violence, which of course gives Beijing an excuse to crack down quite heavily. Police are preparing for these demonstrations on Sunday. Another thing that isn't being talked about much is whether or not the triads will show up for these demonstrations. There were reports that the triads were in force pro-establishment at the last...
Remind us who the triads are.
Well, triads are criminal gangs that have a network across China as well and very active in Hong Kong. So it's certainly a test for Carrie Lam. I think the idea that Hong Kong is soon to turn itself into a self-governing democracy is somewhat naive. And the idea and the notion that Carrie Lam, that it's within her power to either resign or crack down. I mean, she really is in Beijing's hands. It's a decision for her boss, Xi Jinping, to make, in terms of what happens to her and her future.
Ron, within the protest movement itself, it's leaderless, which is apparently one of its virtues. It doesn't have a charismatic leader, a youth movement, if you will. But reports, in addition, these last couple of weeks, that there are divides running through the ranks of the protesters. Some people supported this raid on the Legislative Assembly. A lot of people did not. And it may go to the point that Nina is raising about potential government agitators within sort of dividing the ranks. Just give us a sense of where this goes in the next weeks or months.
Well, it's hard to predict where it goes, but I think this is indicative of what happens to social movements, because when you first start off, everybody is against something, but the longer it goes, you also start to see these fissures between the groups who have different objectives, different goals, different things that they want to accomplish. And I think that that's what's happening here, because there are people who were peacefully protesting who are against the violence that's happening, because they think it's going to lead to a greater crackdown by the Chinese government in Beijing. There are also people who are somewhere in between, who understand the anger that people have that smashed up the legislature, but don't necessarily want to do that themselves. So I think, again, this is sort of indicative of what happens to social movements. I mean, you saw this in the Arab Spring, particularly in Egypt, where everybody was against something. And then as you start to move forward, the fissures happen.
Michael Goldfarb, you're in London. If you go back far enough in history, and you don't have to go too far back, you might lay some of the responsibility for this not at the feet in Beijing, but at the feet in London and the UK government that made Hong Kong a colony. I mean, the antecedents of this conflict go back to where you're sitting.
Well, yeah, but if I can just chime in on what Ron was just saying, it goes back. We saw this in 1968. In America, when you begin to see the civil rights movement begin to fragment, and Dr. King's nonviolent approach to gaining civil rights for African Americans wasn't fast enough for some people. It seems to be an inherent quality in youth-led, you can't call them independence movements, but movements against oppression, movements to guarantee a broad idea of democracy. You know, what's happened here, of course, is that you know, there was, a worry. I covered this for NPR back in 1997 when the handover took place and the negotiations that led up to the, you know, one China, two policies will rule in Hong Kong. So there'd be a Western-style democratic setup here with free markets, while just over the border in the People's Republic, you know, they would have influence and so on. I think that what you'll find, Todd, is that the agreement was based on a certain amount of goodwill and good faith. Britain at the moment is just in no position internationally to, you know, put its feet down in a geopolitical sense and say you are not honoring the agreement, Xi Jinping, you're just not doing it. And we have behind us, you know, an array of, you know, Western alliances, and we will have to, and we can bring this power to bear. It's economic power. You know, Hong Kong is an economically powerful entity in and of itself, and it may actually save the former colony. It may actually save the city because, you know, China at this moment needs to have a financial center just off its southern belly that the world trusts and can do business with. So I think that that's an important thing. The problem, of course, for Britain is that, you know, the foreign secretary is Jeremy Hunt. He is one of two people who is in the finals to replace Theresa May as prime minister. I won't say the name of the other person, the one who's likely to win. I promised your producer I wouldn't. And, you know, he can't do anything. Britain's about to leave the EU. He can't even go to the European Union and say, look, we need to, you know, forcefully say to President Xi that, you know, the approach you're taking in Hong Kong at the moment is not a good one, and we require it to be a free and independent economic entity. He can't do that now. So Britain is actually in a pretty difficult place, and Hong Kong people are in a difficult place if they thought Britain would be able to help them out at
this
moment.
Well, Michael, let's stay in China because you are in London. You are at the BBC right now, and the BBC is reporting that China is systematically separating Muslim children from their families, from their homes and their faiths, while simultaneously building boarding schools to educate and house them, or should I say, re-educate them. Now, this appears to be another attempt to suppress a predominantly Muslim ethnic group, the Uyghurs, who we've heard so much about in the far west of China. Bring us up to speed on these reports that we're hearing, Michael.
Well, this was actually an extraordinary report to see today because the Turkish leader, President Erdogan, is actually in Beijing. He may have flown back to Turkey by now. And he's been reportedly saying some pretty extraordinary things, the Uyghurs aren't being oppressed and this sort of thing because he needs to be, Turkey needs to be part of the Belt and Road Initiative. It's, you know, going to be a Western terminus. And so he's saying the right things while he's on this visit. And the BBC has come up with this really shocking report about children being separated from parents. I guess autocrats Chinese style, and we have autocrats American style when it comes to separating children. It's the one report. It's impossible, by the way, for reporters to get regular contact with what's happening in Xinjiang province, which is where the Uyghurs live. But there does seem to be forcible re-education. And, you know, this isn't it's very difficult to figure out what the upside of all of this is.
All right, Michael, hold the line because I want to make sure we get Ron in before the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, because some of my colleagues, particularly one of my colleagues, Dak King, has done a lot of reporting on this. And I think what you see happening here is a long-term plan by China for social control, because just by sort of cracking down in the region and trying to do this in the regular schools, the parents were still teaching their kids the language and the culture and things at home. But in this way, you separate them from the parents. They don't have the opportunity to do that. And as your point before, you're re-educating these kids, you know, because they're being taught Mandarin. There's no opportunity for the parents to come in and bolster, you know, their culture and language at home. So it seems to be a really long-term plan by the Chinese to stifle consent in that area.
Putting the brakes on their cultural continuity.
Right.
We've seen tactics like this in many, many places. The United States, in Canada, re-education of, of Native First Nations children in Canada, in Australia as well. The Chinese are taking a page, it seems. We're going to take a quick break. It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm speaking with Ron Nixon of the AP, and Nina Maria Potts is here, global news coverage editor at Future Story News. Michael Goldfarb is with us from London. He's host of the first Rough Draft of History podcast. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's the Friday News Roundup, and we're wrapping up the biggest stories from around the world this week. And we'd love to hear from you as well. What questions do you have about the news from around the world this week? What did you not hear enough of, given the media's preoccupation with a certain rainy day parade here in Washington, D.C.? You can tweet us at 1A. Our email address is 1A@WAMU.org. And I am in very good company this hour here in the studio. Ron Nixon from the AP and Nina Maria Potts is here, director of global news coverage at Feature Story News. And on the line from London at the BBC, Michael Goldfarb. He is host of the First Rough Draft of History podcast. Let's go to North Korea. And in some ways, after this week, it seems like a year ago that the president crossed a line in North Korea, but it was only a couple of days ago. He became the first sitting U.S. president to do this.
Stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made.
On Sunday, in front of the world's press, President Donald Trump crossed over from South Korea to North Korea to meet North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un on his own turf. The two talked about restarting negotiations on a nuclear agreement. But on Wednesday, after the United States sent a letter urging United Nations member countries to send back their North Korean workers, the North Korean mission to the UN said that Washington was, quote, more and more hell-bent on the hostile acts against Pyongyang. More rhetoric out of North Korea. Nina Maria, what should we take away from this photo op moment at the border? Was it as spontaneous as the president says it was? He says, I was standing there and Leader Kim said, step over. And I said, he said he'd be honored. And I did. And that was it. More calculated than that? What should we draw from this? Because to the rest of us, this is a first time in history. Big deal.
Well, the surreal optics of that meeting this past weekend, I think if one had a crystal ball looking into the next 2 years or 5 years, I mean, one big question I would love to know is whether or not this president, President Trump, you know, looking back at this time, whether he would have been, you know, an American leader that really broke through North Korea's armor, coaxed North Korea out of its isolation that he achieved, you know, paving the way towards denuclearization, or did he, will we look back and think he created regional chaos that led to the unleashing of a nuclear war? I mean, I think one of the key points here is that if this turns out to be a one-term Trump presidency. North Korea has a lot to lose. And in terms of this summit, this mini summit, it was the first sign of a breakthrough in some time. So in that sense, it was a political victory for President Trump. I think one of the things that's key to this is China and China's relationship both to North Korea and President Trump. There was some speculation that in the trade war between the U.S. and China and in deteriorating relations between Beijing and Washington, that Xi Jinping, as a concession, might have offered to help the U.S. with North Korea. And this was really a swipe in the face of Beijing. President Trump basically signaling to China he doesn't need Beijing to do business with Kim Jong-un.
Michael Goldfarb, there was the optics in the photo op, which looked very nice. It's better to see two leaders of enemy countries shaking hands and smiling than it is to see them rattling sabers at one another, I suppose. But the downside for many analysts of this photo op of President Trump stepping across the border into North Korea was that it was the photo op that Kim wanted, and that the United States gave it up, gave him something he wanted in exchange for exactly nothing.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting, I'm going to challenge the way you framed the question a little, Todd, because it seems to me that at this point in his presidency, we can say that, you know, Donald Trump hasn't changed his habits all that much. I mean, he's a real estate guy, and you could just as easily see him, you know, outside some brownfield site just before groundbreaking. And he's talking to his fellow developer, Mr. Kim, from the Korean American Association. And he says, we're going to build a great building here. He doesn't have the money lined up. He's got nothing in place, but he's got a great photo op, and he walks away. And, you know, this is how he did business, you know, for decades. You know, there's nothing behind it. And I think it's time to start looking at his actions, particularly in foreign policy, as, you know, an extension of the way he did business as a real estate mogul. And I think that these optics are all for him. And I think the speed with which North Korea was back on hostile mode in terms of its pronouncements is proof of that. And I am very curious to know, perhaps Nina knows, you know, when I think it was, did President Xi go to Korea or did Kim go to Beijing in the last couple of weeks?
Kim went to Beijing.
He went, yeah. And what on earth were they talking about that this happened so quickly?
I don't have the answer to that. But well, it's a good question.
And Michael, to your point about the president's handling a foreign policy in the same way he might handle a groundbreaking, of course, it almost goes without saying, but I have to say it, that the stakes are so very much higher in this case. And Ron, meanwhile, even if Michael is completely right, the president is conducting foreign policy with all of the emptiness of a ribbon cutting ceremony for a casino somewhere, there are people in the administration who are still trying to do the work of diplomacy.
Right.
There are people in the apparatus, even though it's haphazard, perhaps, are still trying to do the work. And I've seen a lot of very smart analysts who now say the idea of the big deal, denuclearization for normalization, gone. That was gone in the last round that we reported on several months ago. Right. It's now back to where we were before. Incrementalism and gradual try to get freezes or little tiny tidbits on each side to try to get to a better place.
And I think that's where at least the careerists within State Department are looking at, not this grand deal, but if we can give you something, you give up something. Because as you saw with the rhetoric coming from North Korea, you know, they are not about to just give up their nuclear programs for nothing. They are being hit with crippling sanctions, and that's their biggest focus, is that, well, you got to do something about these sanctions. And the fear is that the president might give up something bigger, like, you know, easing the sanctions for something that is incremental. For a promise from the North
to
Korea.
Say he got
to
a great
say he
deal,
got something, a deal from them, right?
Greatest deal ever. So often it seems to me, when it's time to move on to another high stakes topic from North Korea, that topic is Iran. And it always seems now in American diplomacy and foreign policy, as soon as we're done talking about one very scary point, we talk about the other. So let's go to Iran, because in the year since President Trump chose to pull the United States out of the multi-nation Iran nuclear deal, tensions, of course, between Iran and the U.S. have escalated. We've seen tensions on the lower level in the Persian Gulf, downing of U.S. drones, threats of retaliatory strikes, threats against other shipping this morning reported in the Persian Gulf. But Iran now inching closer towards building the capacity, at least, for nuclear weapons, announcing that it will exceed the uranium enrichment limits under the deal because the U.S. has pulled out of the deal. Why should we stick to these limits when sanctions continue? Nina Maria, what do we know about Iran's actual intentions here, not only with busting the uranium limits, but the small bore stuff, the gunboats in the Gulf, the downing of drones, the needle pricks all over the place that are raising the temperature?
Well, I actually just wanted to mention quite a significant development this week, which was the British seizure of this oil ship off the coast of Gibraltar,
yes,
because that is important in that it's the first time that the EU has taken a publicly aggressive action against Iran. There's always been a question over how seriously the EU takes sanctions. In terms of the US administration's positioning on Iran, the concern is that obviously President Trump is pursuing every possible legal avenue to see what military action can be taken. Ed Luce made the point in the Financial Times this week, which I thought was really interesting, is that in assuming that this is going to be a one-term Trump presidency and making an appalling mistake, that if it turns out to be a two-term Trump presidency, there are going to be losers, and you cannot reset time. You cannot go back in time and assume that when we come out of the presidency, that we will be back where we were. And going back to your point about Iran's ambitions and where it wants to go with its intentions, the implication is that Iran doesn't want to negotiate with this U.S. president and therefore will sit it out for the next one. But there is no going back. And, you know, in 18 months' time, we could be witnessing a full-scale war between the U.S. and Iran. European countries need to be working a lot harder, I think, to break some ground on that.
Michael, do you have the same fears in Iran as you do in North Korea that the president is conducting diplomacy like one of his deals? And if the answer is yes, what about the European allies who are the other part of this equation? Are sanctions are still on and theirs are not?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Well, because they're still signatories to the JCPOA. The actual agreement, their application of sanctions. I mean, they're sort of betwixt and between, and there has been tension about the British seizure. By the way, I mean the Spanish have said, look, you know, this you took this off Gibraltar, which they think is theirs, and you know, so there's already tension within, intramurally within the EU. They're two actually very different situations because North Korea actually has a weapon. So you're dealing with someone who actually can use it. They have delivery systems that can hit a crucial American ally, Japan, and quite possibly the West Coast, but I think that that's an exaggeration. With Iran, it's a different thing. And one of the things that often happens in the view from here, from where I'm sitting in London, is that one of the key players is left out of the conversation in Washington. And I'm speaking of Russia. You know, Iran is entwined with Russia in a deep embrace in Syria. Iran is entwined by geography with Russia. It is a mere 500 miles from Russia's main west coast port on the Caspian Sea to Iran's main port on the southern edge of the Caspian Sea. And Russia has a great deal to say about how far Iran will go in terms of, you know, this is kind of tit for tat. You know, you ratchet up sanctions, we're going to, shoot a drone down that we think is in our airspace, that kind of thing. I suppose the danger is, you know, if there's miscommunication. But I think more than the European Union, I think you really have to look at what the Russian dynamic is in terms of the Iranian situation.
Ron, President Trump responded to the announcement from Iranian President Rouhani, saying that they will enrich uranium. He says, and this is on Twitter, Iran has just issued a new warning. Rouhani says they will enrich uranium to any amount we want if there is no nuclear deal. Be careful with the threats, Iran. They can come back to bite you like nobody has been bitten before. Just a tweet. I don't know how much it tells us about actual American foreign policy. We keep hearing this worry that we may be headed to war, but that last sentence does read like a threat. And the Senate tried unsuccessfully last week to pass an amendment requiring President Trump to ask Congress before taking any military action.
Right. But I think we've seen these kind of threats before from President Trump. And I think there was this feeling that we would have some type of armed conflict with Iran. Which I don't believe that to be the case. I think that the diplomats are trying their best to avert any of this, and that as a lot of them will say, you cannot take the president's tweets as policy. And to Iran's point, I think Iran's target, it's not really the U.S. Their target in terms of trying to influence what's going on is Europe. I mean, they're trying to say, look, you guys need to do something because, you know, we have abided by this agreement that we all agreed to. The U.S. pulled out of this. I mean, you guys are allies with the U.S. You need to do something, but it's unclear exactly what the European countries can do.
And what common leverage they can muster against the with the United States. Well, Ron, I want to trade on your expertise in Sudan, because there was a big agreement. Military and opposition leaders announced today that they've reached an agreement to share power until elections take place in about 3 years. We're talking about a terrible civil war in Sudan. This deal came after protests that led to the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. The military later cracked down in a deadly attack on protesters last month. It's been an awful situation. Some light now in this awful situation. How does this power sharing deal work?
Yeah, this appears to be a pretty major step forward in Sudan, because either there was hope after the Bashir was removed from office, people in the streets celebrating. But then, as you mentioned, you had to crack down. And so there was less optimism about what would happen. And so I think now with this, I think they called it this sovereign council that will be set up, where you would have, I believe, five members of the civilian from civilians and five military people, and then one person that is chosen by both of them that will govern the country for 3 years or a little bit more, and they will take turns sharing power, sharing the leadership. So that's a major step. I think the key here, though, is can they pull it off? I think the agreement is great, and I think everybody agrees that is great, but the key is pulling it off. Can they actually do this? And can they agree on the people who would actually take leadership of this council?
And then the following question, Nina Maria, may be, if all of that is accomplished, as Ron is describing, can the deal hold for any significant amount of time?
Well, I think that is absolutely core to the future of Sudan. As we've seen in South Sudan, attempts to reach a peace deal have stalled, and on an ongoing basis, there's been ethnic violence. We're in a period of relative peace now because finally a peace deal was struck. There are plenty of Sudanese refugees now in South Sudan. The region is obviously dealing with all kinds of different challenges, border violence, ethnic violence. There's a first case of Ebola was found on the border with DRC just this week. I don't know what to say, really. I mean, Omar Bashir, what happens to him, whether he's been active behind the scenes is a real question. It's great news, of course, that there's been some kind of mediation process and an agreement reached with the African Union involved in the future of Sudan. But I think, as Ron says, it's early days.
And has the United States been of any help here, or have we been completely in the background? I'm not even sure of the U.S. role here, if there's been one that's constructive.
To my knowledge, it's been technical with you know, State Department experts obviously taking an active role. But I think as far as this administration's priorities concerned, Sudan is not one of them.
Okay. Well, let's take a breath. Let's cleanse our palates a little bit. We're going to take a break. And while we do that, I have one underreported story to bring you from France. Courtroom drama featuring Maurice. Now, Maurice is a rooster, and an early morning crow has got under the skin of his neighbors. Maurice stands accused of causing noise pollution by a retired couple nearby. His owner, says Maurice, is simply doing what roosters do. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
I am the little red rooster. Too lazy to crow for day.
It's the International Edition of the Friday News Roundup. My guests are Ron Nixon, Nina Maria Potts. Michael Goldfarb is on the line at the BBC in London. Ron, let me stick with you because we were just talking about Sudan. I want to go northwest into Libya, where an airstrike hit a migrant detention center outside of Libya's capital on Tuesday night, leaving, according to reports, at least 53 people dead, 130 wounded. The attack hit a hangar used to detain mostly African migrants captured by Libyan authorities. Nigerian detainee Othman Musa survived the attack. He spoke to France 24.
We want UN to help people out of this place because this place is dangerous. We know it's going to happen like this before, but we don't have any power to do anything.
To make matters worse, in Libya, the United Nations says it received reports that guards fired on migrants fleeing that bombed building. Just days later, a boat carrying migrants trying to reach Europe from Libya sank off the coast of neighboring Tunisia. Only three of the 86 people on board survived that sinking. Ron, do we know who's responsible for that airstrike on the migrant detention center? We do. What motivated them?
We do. The airstrike was done by the Libyan National Army, which is led by a General Khalifa Haftar, who is engaged in a battle for control of the country with the government of National Accord, which is the UN internationally recognized government of Libya. And so his goal is to take over the entirety of Libya, because since Gaddafi was removed, Libya has just broken down. There is no central government. And it is a critical transport country for migrants coming up through various African countries trying to get to Europe. But because there is no central government, these detention centers are run by militias. And so this particular a detention center, according to the Libyan National Army, they weren't trying to hit the detention center. They were trying to hit one of the militias that was in the same neighborhood. They don't deny that it was hit. They just said that it was not their intent.
And do we know anything about their tactics that would go to motivation? In other words, is that claim credible? Do they have a history of bombing detention centers? Would they have a reason to want to murder migrants?
Not to my knowledge. And again, that doesn't mean they have it, but not to my knowledge that they have targeted these detention centers because, you know, again, the detention centers are places where these African migrants are held. And these are folks who the Libyan government has trying to keep from going to Europe, but also to return those folks home. So they're not, it's not like these are welcoming centers for people there.
Nina Maria?
I feel strongly on this, that the EU's sort of moral culpability needs to come under scrutiny. Its deal with Libya that has been 2 years sort of in the making, which demands that Libya retains migrants on that side of the Mediterranean shore in an effort to stop them from boarding boats with people smugglers and making the precarious journey towards Europe. I mean, it's been catastrophic. I think there are real questions around whether or not that policy is basically proving to be a death sentence for refugees. And, you know, there's been significant reporting on what the EU has done to pressure countries along that rim of the Mediterranean to keep migrants in detention camps on those shores, Morocco mm-hmm. and other countries too. But I think Europe's role in all of this needs careful scrutiny.
Mm. Michael, come along with me to Afghanistan because I need your help for a situation there where the Taliban said they were responsible for a major attack on Monday in Kabul, where a car bomb and a gun battle killed roughly 40 people, including school children, and injured 100 people more. An awful attack. It came as negotiators from the United States and the Taliban met for peace talks in Qatar. And in an interview that aired Monday night, President Trump told Tucker Carlson of Fox News that he'd like to get U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. But he said it's not easy.
We've reduced the force very substantially in Afghanistan, which I don't talk about very much, and that's okay.
Could you see getting out entirely?
I'll tell you, the problem is, look, I would like to just get out. The problem is it just seems to be a lab for terrorists. It seems, I call it the Harvard of terrorists.
Michael Goldfarb, why would, though, the Taliban take credit for this attack in the middle of what are supposed to be negotiations for the future of their country?
The Taliban, well, look, the Taliban will continue to apply pressure on both sides. That's how they have always operated. They don't lay down weapons for a period of negotiation, which is sort of what we come to expect. The Taliban always applies pressure. The Taliban is perhaps not as centrally controlled as we might assume it is, because we say the Taliban. There may be factions within. And I think that may well have been the situation, and we don't know what the local situation is on the ground in Kabul, because there could be tensions that have been building up and a faction decides, well, we're going to do this now while everybody's in Qatar having a talk. Mm. This is how that world goes.
Michael, the president made a remark there in his Fox News comments that stood out. He said, you don't hear about it much, we don't talk about it much, and that's okay. The president's right. We don't hear much from him on Afghanistan. We don't hear much from Democrats in Congress or Democrats on the campaign trail. And yes, it's true, Americans tend to not be incredibly concerned with foreign policy. At the same time, it seems like the upper echelons of this country are not focused there and maybe just want us out.
Well, you know, troops every time they try and reduce troops, something happens. They can't get rid of all of them. And yes, I mean, I think there are still colleagues based in Afghanistan, but how often do they get on the air? How often do they get in the papers? And there is a dynamic which we sometimes forget that, you know, if there is no pressure coming up through journalism, reporting to people and people saying, geez, we've got to do something about this, then policymakers in Washington may not feel quite the same pressure to deal with the situation. And, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the clock, not because I'm in a hurry to go, but look at the number of crises we have already discussed.
Indeed.
And we've still got another, 10 minutes to talk. Now, that's a lot of work.
Indeed.
For the State Department to be getting on with. It's a lot of focus for the administration to be trying to focus on. And let's face it, the reporting domestically is that this is not a White House which has a lot of focus. So it becomes a real problem. You know, what is I'd like to go back, if we may, just to what Nina was saying about Libya and the European Union. I mean, this is actually the source of the migrant crisis. It has so destabilized the political equilibrium of Europe, just as, you know, it's kind of destabilized politics in America down on the southern border. You know, these are the crises that people look at. More closely, Todd. And so Afghanistan, which has been going on for us since 2001, that's almost 20 years, you know, it's like the forever war and it gets forgotten. Mm.
The longest war in American history, even though it seems like it's at a very low level, at least for the United States now, a war nonetheless. Well, crisis around the world calls for leadership around the world. We look to our leaders to handle these crises and to exact diplomacy on our adversaries to keep the violence at a minimum. Did we ever count on Chief Diplomat Ivanka Trump handling matters for the United States? And I ask it because it's been a very significant week for many women on the world stage. But let's talk about Ivanka, who gave some rather awkward footage to the world press. A lot of memes were generated when the president's daughter started trying to engage with world leaders at the G20. Nina Maria, what was Ivanka Trump doing at the G20? And did she know that she was going to generate all those memes?
Good question. Was this the week that the hashtag unwanted Ivanka was born? I mean, the body language, we have various body language experts coming out to examine the way in which she conducted herself, the awkward moments in which she superimposed and imposed herself in conversations at the G20, the videos. I think the real concern is that this whole incident wasn't just awkward. It could have really damaged American diplomacy. And if you're standing in Beijing, frankly, even North Korea, and seeing Ivanka Trump wading into discussions with world leaders, the question is, what is she doing there? And of course, the answer to that may be that she herself or her father is lining her up to be possibly a next president. I would make one point about Ivanka Trump, which is that we've spent the week laughing at that incident and her appearance at the G20. We spent a lot of time laughing at President Trump in 2016. When the prospect of him becoming president just seemed obscure and completely surreal. We're not laughing anymore.
Point well taken. Michael Goldfarb, if your premise that the president conducts world affairs like a ribbon-cutting ceremony at a casino, then the corollary is, why not? Why not have Ivanka there in the photo op? Why not have her mingling with presidents of foreign countries? Get her in there, even though she doesn't have experience on the world stage. Why not?
Well, you know, it's funny, Todd, you asked this question. When I started the podcast, it was just before Trump won the election, and I was going to do something else with First Rough Draft of History, and I ended up being almost about Trump. And I put together a panel, including my friend Mina Al-Oraibi, who's the editor of The National, which comes out of Abu Dhabi. And she said that Donald Trump is going to do incredibly well with the Arab rulers in the Middle East because he brings his family into it. And this is the way they've always done business in the Middle East. You know, if you want to talk to the king, then you speak to his son. And I think that there is, I mean, we do laugh, but, you know, there is, I think there's actually, that is something that is very clear now to world leaders, certainly in the Middle East, but perhaps elsewhere, that if you want to get President Trump's ear, you're best off having an established relationship with Jared Kushner or now, as we see, with Ivanka, because they actually get his ear. Whereas, you know, a White House full of high-priced people like John Bolton don't have his ear. And that is a very important point to make. We can laugh. Nina's right. We shouldn't laugh too loud. There may actually be method here. It may not be traditional, and it may not be effective in the long run, but for the moment, this is the method.
Well, I want to raise another name. The name of Ivanka Trump is not new to Americans. Here's a name that might be new, Nina Maria, just new on the world stage. Talk about powerful women in front of the world. Ursula von der Leyen, is a longtime close ally of Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, and she's emerged from the shadows, a person that many people have not heard before. She's now nominated as the new president of the European Commission. Who is she?
Well, she's a German defense minister. In fact, Angela Merkel has abstained. She abstained from that vote because she had issues with her coalition resisting that nomination. EU lawmakers as well are extremely cross with her nomination. There were marathon negotiations that lasted at least 48 hours in Brussels this week. I mean, nice from my perspective as a woman to see, you know, certainly Christine Lagarde and this surprise nomination of the German defense minister. You know, it's great to see women nominated. I think that we've still got a way to go before either of those nominations are endorsed. And certainly lawmakers, I think, were thrown and certainly articulated quite a degree of anger that they're not the nominations that they would have opted for.
Oh, one of the photos that we saw on Twitter and Instagram of Ivanka Trump, among the many people she rubbed elbows with during the week was Christine Lagarde, who you just mentioned. She's somebody that plenty of people have gotten to know over the years. She's chaired the International Monetary Fund since 2011, and she's now taking over as the president of the European Central Bank, a very powerful position. It's been noted that we now have another lawyer in charge of another very powerful bank. Of course, they're going to be giving attention to her for being the first woman to lead the ECB, of course, but she is she very much part of the status quo at the ECB? What can Europeans expect from her?
Well, Christine Lagarde is, you know, her tenure at the IMF has been somewhat controversial. And, you know, she's a known entity on the global stage and is deemed a safe pair of hands. And I think in unpredictable times of market uncertainty in Europe, you know, it seems that a safe pair of hands is what the European Central Bank needs. And, you know, it's an added bonus that she's a woman, but she doesn't come without her own set of issues.
Indeed. And one of the things that Christine Lagarde does have to offer is this conversation about powerful women on the world stage. And she talked about it on The Daily Show, Trevor Noah on Comedy Central, about the question of why men are still paid more than women in 2019. She addressed this directly.
This is a complete waste of time and waste of energy and waste of resources. So women have to be given the same opportunities, be given the same salary, and have the same exactly rights as men.
Christine Lagarde taking over the European Central Bank with a message.
Indeed.
Indeed. Well, I want to thank my guests for being here for the international edition of the Friday News Roundup. Michael Goldfarb, host of the first Rough Draft of History podcast. You are there in London. Michael, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Nina Maria Potts, director of global news coverage, Feature Story News. Nina Maria, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ron Nixon, international investigations editor at the Associated Press, author of the book Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Thanks to you, Ron.
Thank you.
And before I leave you, let's give a note to U.S. Women's World Soccer in France. They've been crushing it during the Women's World Cup, dominating each round. They blew past a determined England early in the week. Sorry to our executive producer, Rupert Allman, who's an England fan. TV audience here in the United States, north of 7 million, making it the most watched soccer game on English language TV since the Men's World Cup final. The U.S. play the Dutch this weekend, and when you're watching them, ask yourself this: are you watching just a team, or are you watching a movement? I'm going to say it's the latter. Go Team USA. The game is on Sunday at, I believe, 11 a.m. So get up, have your coffee, sleep late, and then put on your kit because the U.S. women are in the final of the World Cup. I want to thank you all for joining us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.